Is there intelligent life in the universe?
Will we one day be able to time travel?
And which one of these two scenarios is more likely?
What if aliens were actually future versions of humans? Today on What If Discussed. Welcome to What If Discussed. I'm Peter Smeachin.
And I'm Richard Garner. So, Pete, aliens.
Do you believe in them?
Do I believe in them? I mean, please. I mean, that's a long conversation. It's a complex conversation, as we're going to find out today. But let me start with you. Do you believe we are alone in the universe?
Just you and me here.
Yes, right just now. You and I. Well, of course,
there's two guys
our crew.
Behind the camera.
There's
there.
People here as well. But yes, we're on a bit of an island. But I guess what I mean are human beings on the big blue marble here unique?
I'm going to say yes. Hmm. I think yes, we are unique in that we are probably, and this is very hubristic, I'm sure, that we are the sole intelligent species in at least our galaxy. I don't know what's happening in the other galaxies. Nobody does.
No.
Obviously, it's smart to say, well, there's this many planets that are in Goldilocks zones of suns about the size of this, and Earths with this, and with gravity and water and blah, blah, blah. There's got to be, you know, they say thousands of planets similar to ours. Doesn't mean that there's intelligent life on them. There could be amoeba on them. There could
so
be
you're open to life?
I'm open to life, for sure. I think if there is something as intelligent as us, it would have found us. Well, maybe not as intelligent as us, a little smarter than us, it would have found us. If it's not as smart as us, it wouldn't have found us.
I believe and that's why the old Fermi paradox.
Well, there you go.
Ish.
Fermi paradox-ish, yeah.
Something like that. But to your point, the idea that we would have sort of bumped into each other at some point, whether they're looking for us, whether they would have found us, whether we would have seen evidence of them over the course of X amount of time. I would personally argue that our time that we've had that level of advanced technology that we could know those things is a blip in human history. So we still get caught up in the idea that we kind of got things figured out. And I think it's very early in the game in, you know, if we've been around, you know, the planet's been around for 4 billion years, this version of human beings supposed to be a couple hundred thousand, I guess, 100,000, whatever it is. So is it possible that, you know, in a couple thousand years, we would have more information and ability and telescopes, whatever, to be able to figure this out better? But the math is compelling to me. I do believe that you know, the more exoplanets we find, it seems to be like a yearly thing now, right? It's like every second week you're hearing about, oh, they found an exoplanet, to your point that, you know, whether it's, or even when we grew up, water on Mars was like, forget about
That's
it.
Not
no chance.
Yeah.
Bam, we find evidence of water on Mars, right?
But there was always little green men.
Yeah, and that was the interesting starting point. It's a good sort of segue to what we're going to be discussing today, because that idea that kind of got, you know, imprinted on us, to your point, from probably science fiction when we were kids, and was this idea that there was a very specific kind of, you know,
look to an alien,
a short, sort of hairless, big eyes, green or gray.
Large brain,
take us to your leader, like that type of stuff. So A, it was easily dismissed and marginalized, but B, it kind of created this idea that that's what we would be looking for or expecting, because it also coincided with a lot of, you know, UFO accounts of whether it be seeing or abduction, whatever. But what I hadn't considered before, although it was kind of pitched to me by my brother-in-law, a sci-fi book idea back in the day that was similar to the theory that we're going to be discussing today with the author, well, literally the man who wrote the book on the subject, about the idea that in fact, not to say there's no alien life, but that these visitations, these grays, these little green men or whatever we've discussed over the time, aren't actually from off planet or alien. They're in fact us from the future, time traveling back. Now that, how does that land with you? More or less compelling?
More compelling and more possible, I would think. Because if we are us in the future, then of course we're going to be smart enough to be able to come back. I don't anticipate that any alien race is coming to visit us for any reason, and why would they make themselves so scarce and so so mystical and invisible to us? But yeah, us in the future, and this could be the future being 40 million years.
Yes.
Not talking about 200 years. This is not some sort of, you know, Back to the Future 3 business.
Yes.
This is like us. We've already moved off the planet onto some sort of O'Neill cylinder, and we've come up with the possibility of coming back and visiting the old people on Earth.
I like this.
And for various reasons, which we'll probably get into a little later, but I think that's more plausible, that it's us rather than it's some other species that evolved at the exact same time as us over, you know, all we know is 4.5 billion years of living in the universe. For all we know, the universe has been around for...
ad infinitum.
Yeah, ad infinitum. So they're... Who knows?
Yes.
It's all mind-boggling.
Well, you know who might know? Our guest today.
Our guest? Well, shall I introduce him?
Yes, perfect timing.
Today's guest literally wrote the book on the subject. Dr. Mike Masters is a professor of anthropology at Montana Tech University. Dr. Masters received his PhD from The Ohio State University and has participated in archaeological digs all over the world. His passion for the study of human evolution, combined with a lifelong interest in UFOs, led him to write Identified Flying Objects, in which he postulates that aliens are not in fact alien at all, but are in fact humans from the future time traveling back to better understand their path.
Dr. Masters, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me on, guys. It's a pleasure to be here.
So before we start going down the rabbit holes, I guess, what prompts or inspires, let's say, a PhD level anthropologist to really take on two of the biggest rabbit holes out there, aliens and time travel?
Well, it actually started when I was only about 8 years old. Some friends were over at our house and I overheard my father telling a story about a UFO he saw. He was a veterinarian in Amish country in a pretty rural part of Northeast Ohio. And I just remember it piquing my interest. And it wasn't long after that that he got the book Communion by Whitley Strieber. And I remember very vividly looking up and seeing that book on the living room shelf. And I had this image pop in my mind. For those that aren't familiar, the book has sort of the quintessential gray alien on the cover. And I remember having this mental image of an early hominin or chimpanzee-like form, a modern human in the middle, and then this quintessential alien form on the right side. And I had sort of a what-if moment. I thought, well, what if they're just us from the future, coming back through time to study their own evolutionary past? So it was something that kind of stuck with me throughout my life. And I've always kind of pursued that question and eventually decided to take a little farther and spend a good amount of time investigating it and writing a book about it.
Now, Dr. Masters, you stress that this is a multidisciplinary scientific study and not just speculation. Tell us about the process and the time that went into it.
Yeah, well, once I did finally decide to start putting words to page, it was about, actually, I remember specifically October 2012. And I was coming up on tenure. I was getting close to promotion to full professor. And I thought, you know what? What better time to do it? And so I hired a couple research assistants and sort of explained the premise to them. And we mostly focused on the different disciplines, multidisciplinary. The ones we focused on specifically were physics, astronomy, astrobiology, and then my field of anthropology and biological anthropology foremost. And yeah, over the course of the previous 7 years, we just kind of worked to build a case around this, looking at the extraterrestrial hypothesis as an explanation for these craft and the beings that purportedly pilot them. And just to kind of see what the most parsimonious explanation was, what made the most sense in the context of what people describe seeing. And it seems to fit very neatly into this time travel model.
Well, of those disciplines, you mentioned anthropology being your area of focus and expertise. Help us understand, through your understanding of human evolution, why this then is not a really massive leap going forward, that, you know, how we might evolve as human beings 1,000 years from now, millions of years from now, and how that fits into sort of really creating the foundation for this theory.
Yeah, I mean, I started off as a physics and astronomy major as an undergraduate, and then switched to anthropology late in my sophomore year, and decided to look more at the human evolution side of things. And it's always fascinated me, and I'm really glad I did that. I've gotten the opportunity to work in digs in South Africa, 3.5 million year hominin site, Australopithecus africanus specifically, a Neanderthal site dating back 250,000 years ago in southern France. And I've led digs all around the United States here where I've lived. So the main crux of the argument, I guess, looks at these long-term evolutionary trends throughout human evolution. So initially, we were quadrupedal, just like all other hominoids, just like pretty much every other mammal. We're tetrapods. We have four limbs. We have pentadactyly. We have five digits on each limb. But then something unique happened between 6 and 8 million years ago, and we stood up. We became bipedal, and that's actually the characteristic that defines the hominin clade, is our bipedalism. And as that happened, what needed to happen is that we had to rotate our heads down so that we could see where we're going. And as that took place, there's a number of craniofacial changes that occurred. Most notably, there was a flexing of the basic cranium. So the part of our skull where the brain sits, there's the anterior, the middle, and then the posterior. And as that flexed, in order for us to see and for all of these changes to take place in association with bipedalism, it created more space within the skull for a brain to grow. And we oftentimes talk about the slinky hypothesis, and I brought a little slinky along to show you.
First of all, I'm loving the props, by the way. Thank you.
Oh yeah, it's the best, especially slinkies. I mean, how can you go wrong with that? So if we imagine the back end of the slinky is the foramen magnum, the part of our skull where the rest of the body connects through the spinal cord. And as that rotated down, so our heads could sit more on top of our skulls, and our face rotated down and backwards, you can see that there's all this space at the top where it created more room for our enlarged brain. So that took place in association with the reduced face. The traits that now define our specific species, Homo sapiens sapiens, is what's called a globular neurocranium. We have a big round head. It's always sort of increased the frontal lobe, and the parietal lobes have expanded mediolaterally, meaning left to right. But this globular neurocranium that we have today is a trait that defines us as modern humans, going back about 200,000 years. We also have a chin, a mental eminence, which is unique to our species. Our hominin ancestors don't have that. So long story short, if we look at these trends that have continued, not just in our cranial facial anatomy, but our postcranial anatomy too, and if we project those into the future, we're very likely to have these same traits that are so commonly described in these instances of close encounters, specifically the big round heads, the large wraparound eyes, oval-shaped eyes, reduced faces even beyond our own, little tiny pointy chins, smaller ears, more childlike traits. I talk about neoteny and pedomorphosis in the book a lot. So just looking at these dominant trends in human evolution, if they continue into the future, we are likely to look very much like these alien beings.
Neoteny and pedomorphosis? Is that what you said?
Yeah, I probably should have backtracked on that a little bit too. They're not common terms. So neoteny is this process that characterizes human evolution as well. And all it is the retention of juvenilized traits into adulthood. So we retain more infantile, juvenile, childlike characteristics, even as adults. And we can already see this throughout human evolution. If we look at a modern human and we compare them to an infant chimpanzee and an adult chimpanzee, we're much more like the infant chimpanzee because they have those juvenile traits. And I actually argue in the book, if you look at children now, especially young children, even fetuses, they have these very alien-like characteristics, big round heads, big eyes, small faces. So if this same trend continues into the future, this pedomorphosis, it could help explain why they look so infantile. They're oftentimes described as being childlike or sometimes even fetal. I came across a report recently that described them as being overgrown fetuses, I think was the words they used.
Okay, so we've explored the future us part of the equation, but What about time travel? If we're going to give you the benefit of the doubt that we've cracked that nut sometime in the future, how are we doing it? How are we coming back?
Yeah, it's a great question. And obviously a very important part of this model is, what about time travel? Is it even possible? There was a really interesting study by Ehrman et al. That came out in 2009 called "Do the Laws of Physics Forbid the Operation of Time Machines?" And they looked at all of the different theories, both pro and con. A lot of people like Stephen Hawking was very anti-time travel. So they looked at all of these different theories for how it might work, the actual physics behind it, but then also looking at philosophy and history. Philosophers have been debating this question of time travel for centuries. And what is time? They really originated this question. And what they found is that there's nothing in the laws of physics or in any of these other disciplines that forbid the operation of a time machine, and specifically backward time travel. So that's a good argument in favor of the fact that it could exist. But the actual how, to get to your question specifically, ever since Einstein published his theory of general relativity back in 1915, there's been a number of solutions to his field equations that were published in association with them that demonstrate how we could create closed time-like curves. And essentially what that means is that if we think of a light cone, this is usually how we conceptualize the future, past, and our present, even though the present arguably doesn't exist. If you turned on a beam of light, it shines out, a flashlight, say, it shines out this light. Everything that can take place has to be within the boundaries of the cone that forms as it radiates outward, simply because nothing can go faster than the speed of light. So in order to travel into the past, we have to somehow orient those light cones downward toward the past. And a number of solutions to these field equations, starting with Lenz and Thurien in 1918, we have Van Stockham in the 1930s, the Gödel metric, this rotating infinitely massive universe. And then eventually with Frank Tipler in 1974, I think it was, published a paper showing how we can create this frame dragging effect, this warpage of space-time that reorients those light cones toward the past, which allows an individual to travel locally, still into the future. They're still going forward, but globally, they're going back into the past. And since then, there's been a number of other studies that have shown the same thing, that if you have a large enough mass or a big enough energy and it's rotating at a very high rate of speed, that you're able to create these closed time-like curves. And many descriptions of these UFOs are describing that same thing. To kind of tie this together, a large disc-shaped object spinning at a very high rate of speed, emitting a tremendous amount of energy. There's this overwhelming static electricity in the air. Electromagnetism is always described in association with them. So in the context of everything that's been shown about how we do this in the laws of physics, seems to fit nicely with how these craft actually appear to be.
So you've piqued my interest, and now then we sort of move on to, again, let's sort of grant you, you've passed the next stage of verification, of validation, and now we get to alien abduction, where that's been described in many cases. You know, we kind of hear about the probing or the anal probing or whatever, but I mean, it's sometimes made into a joke, but then in some cases, people have described some pretty horrible events, whether it be to farm animals back in the day with cows and whatever. But basically, if you were to zoom out and look at it, you could say objectively, well, there's something going on. There's some learnings, that are, something's trying to be derived from it. It's not just random. Mm-hmm. So you've described in the book that, yes, well, this could be scientific research from future us coming back here to understand something about what's going on here that could help in the future, whatever that might be. So let me put you on the spot. Again, you're an anthropologist. Let's say we figure out the time travel, as we said earlier, and now you're being asked to go back into the past to be part of a team to go and do some research. First of all, are abductions on the table? And secondly, would you be up for it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, even just to have the opportunity to meet future humans in our time and to observe their morphology, their craniofacial form, their technology, their way of communicating, which by all accounts, seems to be telepathy, which is fascinating to me. At least at some point in the distant future, we may acquire that ability, whether it be a technological implant or just some aspect of the brain itself. There's no way I could know that. But yeah, I would absolutely go along. I think it would be tremendously fascinating to go to any point in the future, and especially because so many of these reports, there was a really interesting study by the Dr. Edgar Mitchell Foundation, a former astronaut who was really interested in this question of UFOs.
Sixth man to walk on the moon.
Yeah, yeah. And they found that the overwhelming majority of contactee experience were positive. They really enjoyed interacting with these beings. They described this this really impactful sense of empathy and love, and always talking about avoiding violence and war. So to be able to live in that world, or even to visit it for a short period of time, I think would not only be really mind-opening, but it would also be a really great experience just to feel that more evolved sense of human society and love and compassion. But to your question about what we would do or why we would do it, yeah, absolutely. Abductions are completely on the table. I think that the abduction phenomenon is largely anthropologists from the future doing exactly what I would do if I had access to this technology now. I would pick them up. I would take hair samples, saliva samples, skin samples, fecal samples. As you mentioned, the anal probe thing. You can learn so much from poop. I mean, it sounds weird to say, but that's how we know that we consumed about 7,000 calories per day as Neanderthals, and mostly meat, by the way, is that we found their turds. And we could break those down and look at the molecular composition and realize that this was their diet. So if you want to learn not just about people's diet, but so many other things about them, you can definitely do that through fecal matter. So beyond that, I mean, they picked them up. I'd like to preface this by saying, too, that this is a more tenuous part of the argument. We don't have proof of this happening. Recently, the Navy and the Pentagon confirmed the Tic Tac UFOs that were observed in 2004, and then another one more recently. So we have confirmation of these craft now, which I think is great, but we still don't have anything that we can really put our finger on and say, yes, that's an abduction and that's happening. So with that said, if we do take these people seriously, and if we do look at all of these different reports, the fact that they're doing exactly what we as anthropologists would do if we had access to this technology really indicates to me that they are, in fact, us, and they're largely here to gather information.
It seems weird to me, though, because we document everything, seemingly, in this day and age. So if it is, in fact, we coming back to investigate us, what exactly are we trying to learn? Because isn't it all laid out on the table?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point. It would almost seem, and based on the physical traits most commonly described, and especially those gray alien forms, that this is a very distant point in our future. We're talking tens of thousands of years. And even with our best technology to archive paintings and the data that we have now electronically, look how fast our iPhones change and our computers change. Even if you were to go back and try to find information from 100 years ago, especially with wars, we're constantly blowing up archives and destroying monuments and bits of information. It's possible that they won't survive. And it may also help explain why we don't just see regular old humans that often. Why would we come back to a time where we already have that information? It would make more sense to come back to a time when we don't have it anymore. We've lost that. It's not available to us, and especially the biological data.
So does this particular hypothesis, which is the future us coming back, time travel to, again, learn more about previous generations of human beings on the evolutionary track to probably help whatever it is we're trying to solve in the future. Does that, though, take off the table the idea that there's also possibly other intelligent species in the universe who also are traveling throughout the universe and potentially even coming here as well?
No, not at all. I don't see these as mutually exclusive at all. And I also acknowledge the psychocultural hypothesis in the book that it's really once we started to become spacefaring beings ourselves that we get more UFO reports, and we would have a tendency to anthropomorphize those as well and interject our own appearance onto them by thinking, well, if we're going to space, there must be all of these other civilizations that are also doing it, and that those things need to be considered. The fact that life arose here on Earth so soon after it could, in the context of the 4.5 billion year history of the Earth, 3.7 billion years, we start to get prokaryotes, and we were very simple single cellular organisms for a long time, reproducing just by mitosis, dividing. And it took a very long time to get to where we are. So that could definitely happen on another planet. However, it's very unlikely that on that planet, wherever it is in the universe, that they would have a similar gravity to us. It's already difficult for us to walk bipedally. We suffer from what's known as the perils of being bipedal, a paper by the former director of the Natural History Museum in Cleveland published this back in the 70s. Bruce Latimer was his name specifically, that we suffer from things like herniated discs, bad knees, bad necks, varicose veins, hernias, hemorrhoids. All of these things are a negative result of being bipedal. So if we had a slightly larger planet that was more than 9.8 meters per second squared gravity, we're not likely to be bipedal at all. And what we've found from a number of studies carried out by the Arecibo Observatory in Costa Rica, that only about 2.2% of all the planets that have been discovered as part of the Kepler mission are actually the same size as or smaller than Earth. So if we have more gravity, we're not likely to be bipedal like we are. It's very hard for us here. We're one of the only mammals that is habitually bipedal. If they have a different chemical composition, a different distance from their sun, different atmosphere, they're not likely to have the same DNA coding system that we have. There's so many reasons why they wouldn't look anything like us. So I definitely don't discount that there's life on other planets. I just don't think that it necessarily helps explain the UFO phenomenon and the contactee experiences that are so ubiquitously reported.
So we are special, Pete, to some degree, it sounds like.
We're special.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I'd like to think so anyways. Look, this is wildly fascinating. We could go on all day about this, but we really appreciate you not only sort of taking us on a journey, but also doing it with, you know, the benefit of your background, expertise, and pedigree as an anthropologist, and taking a real serious look at something that I think is obviously something that at the very least fascinates a lot of people, and at the very most is something that people are going to consider more and more as we go forward. So thanks for that. Where can people find more about your work?
I have a website for the book, and I have a new book coming out later this year. The website's just a shortened version of the title, Identified Flying Objects. So IDFLYOBJ, IdFlyObj.com. And there's links to all the different formats of the book, audiobook, ebook, and obviously paperback. And some more information about speaking events, which have obviously been somewhat curbed on account of the virgin soil pandemic we're all dealing with. But it's just keeping people up to date largely through the website.
And I strongly recommend, it's not just, again, a fascinating read as a sci-fi book might be. In this particular case, it's kind of like you're reading, I don't want to say a textbook because that might sound dry to people, but it's certainly you're being taken with the benefit of the sort of the parallel scientific explanation or theorization for everything that's being tabled, yeah. Which you can appreciate, kind of like Star Trek back in the day, right? Like when they would at least
introduce the new ideas and go and explore.
But you'd be like, oh, that's interesting, because they explain the science behind it theoretically. I could see that existing one day. And as we know, many of those things do exist.
Speaking of, too, the prime directive in that show, I mean, trying to avoid interjecting yourself or influencing them too much. That's the same thing we see with this phenomenon. And you would expect that of a time travel model, but not necessarily if another being schlepped across the universe to get here. We would expect them to at least get out and say hello or kill us all and take our resources or something. But the fact that that doesn't happen, I think, lends more credence to this time travel model as well.
Very good point, and great point to end on. Thanks a lot, Dr. Masters, for joining us, and we'll catch up with you down the line.
Appreciate it.
All right, thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
So, Pete, where are you now after talking to Dr. Mike Masters for a while? Are you leaning towards the possibility that we are in fact being visited by future versions of us?
Well, I believe it even more now. I thought we would be talking to someone who's...
out there?
A little bit out there. Yeah, I didn't know much about Dr. Mike Masters before today. And it seems that he's a very intelligent man and has done a lot of research into this and believes it with all his heart. So I think he's got a point, and it's very possible.
Well, it's interesting, the approach from an anthropologist, right? I mean, you've heard also probably 1,000 books written on different subjects of ufology with various ranges within the spectrum of credible to crazy or whatever it might be. But what I had never come across was the idea of an anthropologist's perspective on this. So we, as humans, or present-day humans, are often guilty of believing somehow, whether stated or not, that evolution ended here, right? Like, we're done.
Yeah.
Like, it was always, all those, like, Homo erectus, Cro-Magnon, finished with us.
Every day. I mean, why would you think, why would you go through life, you know, going to the pharmacy thinking that...
Yeah, yeah, that there's 2 million, 3 million, 4 million years, or some people might say no, because we might not be around.
Well,
that's a what if.
That might be, that's a question for another what if.
Yes.
But that's a good point. It's like,
yes,
we're living in a nihilist society where we assume we're all going to die, that global warming's going to knock us off, we're going to have to leave the planet. This world may be over, so why would we even imagine that there's another...
All the sci-fi is dystopian. Almost every future version or vision of humanity is post-nuclear war or post-zombie apocalypse or post-whatever.
Yeah.
And people don't necessarily spend a lot of time thinking, A, about a long-term future for the species, these days especially, but B, they don't postulate the fact that, well, wait a sec, if Homo habilis and Neanderthal looked like this, 100,000, 200,000, whatever, to 3 million, whatever, then what would we... evolve to look like in a million or 2 million years? And Dr. Mike Masters makes a very good point that everything is trending. Unfortunately, I can't remember the name off the top of my head about the immature thing.
The fetus.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And like the idea that we actually are taking on features of...
We're becoming fetal.
We're becoming fetal.
Yeah, the aliens are all, they all look like giant fetuses, giant babies. And, or babies all look like, well, obviously aliens look like giant babies.
Egg or chicken there. And I mean, I was happy because I've been telling people for years that I am devolving and I'm getting more immature.
You certainly are.
But in terms of devolving traits though, like, I mean, it's very interesting because without that connection, the little green men you talked about or the gray that we've seen in movies, it was just some sort of abstract thing that, oh, sure, whatever. It was somebody's idea as to what an off-planet being might look like. But if you do start to, and again, I mentioned my brother-in-law before, he had pitched this idea that global warming, which obviously isn't that far-fetched, even though he was pitching this 20 years ago, ultimately forced us underground. As a species, the sun got hot, whatever it was, the ozone layer was too, whatever, and we could no longer live on the surface of the Earth. And human society moved underground and lived underground for thousands and millions of years. And his theory was that, well, obviously if you were living underground, you'd get shorter, you would have, you know, your eyes would be bigger because it'd be less light. All of the same things as kind of Dr. Masters was talking about will be part of our natural evolution. But again, from an anthropologist, that now sort of, it makes the whole idea a lot more plausible.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a lot to prime directives. We're talking about, you know, a whole bunch of different things. But in the end, again, you talked off the top. The idea of somebody coming here from, you know, some other galaxy and whatever and just watching us for a while, visiting occasionally,
it
sounds less plausible than this, which at least there's stake here. If we, meaning the future us,
are them
coming back here, we're coming back for a reason.
Yeah.
It'd be more than just curiosity. There would have to be something we think we can learn that's going to help us in the future.
I think so. The perils
solved
of being bipedal.
Yes.
Was my favorite line.
If I had a nickel for every time I said that.
Whoa. Welcome back to our continued discussion with Dr. Mike Masters, professor of anthropology at Montana Tech University and author of Identified Flying Objects. So, Dr. Masters, how has your book and this theory been received by the rest of the scientific community?
Yeah, it's been really interesting, actually. I had no idea what to expect when I came out with this book last year. And to be honest, I was a little scared. I've worked really hard in my field and have developed some great friends and collaborators all across the world, really prominent anthropologists. We've published in some really respected peer-reviewed journals. So I was kind of putting that all on the line and writing a book, as you mentioned earlier, not just about aliens, but also time travel, which is also a bit of a taboo topic. But I realized that it's important. I mean, there's really no reason why we shouldn't be talking about these things. And it's the job of scientists to be asking questions and to be investigating these large unknown aspects of the world around us. So I kind of threw caution to the wind and published the book and just kind of waited to see what happened. And to be honest, I was tremendously pleased with the response. At my book release party, there's a massive crowd, and I'd say probably 40% of the people there had PhDs or master's degrees. The chair of my department, the dean, the chancellor of my university, all have seen various media stories, articles about the book, and have been really excited by the response. So there's obviously haters. Haters are going to hate no matter who you are, what you're doing. So I've seen those as well, but even outside of my institution, and especially the people that know me and know my research and what I've done leading up to this point are very encouraging and enthusiastic about it. So I've really been quite happy with the response thus far.
So back to the theory, and we know that, you know, we talked about the sort of standard gray alien model, right? The sort of, not sort so much the ET looking, but you know, more those little guys at Close Encounters of the Third Kind, the sort of the short, big eyes, hairless heads, very little noses, that type of. But we do know that there have been reports about other types of beings being here, whether it be sort of more Nordic looking. This goes more into South America and some of those ancient civilizations talking about those encounters. But there have been other types of species described. Is it possible, according to your theory, that we could be being visited by different versions of us from different periods of time in the future?
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, absolutely. And that's something I write about in the book in the context of what I call temporal ancestry. So we don't use the term race anymore because it doesn't really give us any valid biological criteria for establishing differences among people. So we use the term ancestry, and especially in forensic anthropology and biological anthropology, to describe the differences among people, because there are clear physical differences among sub-Saharan Africans, Native Americans, Europeans, and so on. So in the book, I debate whether the differences we see in the physical form of these extratempestrials, as I call them, whether that's just a continuation of these ancestral geographic racial divisions, or if we're seeing people from different time periods. And if that's the case, we would expect to see some variation in their physical form. If they're coming from 100 years in the future, obviously they're going to look very similar to us. 20,000 years in the future, they're going to be quite a bit different, but still rather similar. 100,000, 200,000 years, now we're talking about some pretty marked differences. And the same thing would apply if we went back. If we went back 200 years, picked people up, they'd be like, what are you people doing? Why are you here? We'd look different. Our technology would be more advanced, but they'd still recognize us as human. If we go and pick up Homo erectus 1.5 million years ago, now we're the ones with the big round heads, the big eyes, the small faces. We are the aliens, just the flip side of it as we describe them from the future. So I think that temporal ancestry is important and helps explain not just the grays, who are arguably farther from us in time, but also why there are actual reports of real humans described as men and women in very human terms. In fact, this new book I'm working on looks at a number of case studies, and the first two describe that first scenario I just mentioned, where they are extremely human individuals who communicate with vocalized speech in the same way we do, who have slightly different facial features, the more accentuated traits that characterize our evolutionary history, but they are human. But then once we get to things like the reptilians or insect-like creatures that are so commonly described, it's possible that those are from a very distant point in our future, and potentially, I don't know if I subscribe to this, but it could be an aspect of it, potentially a post-human, a post-hominin world where some other being with greater survivability, which reptiles and insects have definitely proven over the years, they develop consciousness and they develop the technology to travel back through very long periods of time. So it could help explain some of those other variants as well.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that. It's not necessarily humans. It could be that, you know, brown bears overtook us and it somehow began to rule the world and then grew huge brains and developed a way to come back and visit us. You talk a bit about form follows function when you describe disc-shaped objects from UFO sightings. Now, when we see flying saucers, do you see time travel machines?
I do, yeah. That's a great way of putting it, actually. We have this expression in biology that form follows function. We can look at the form of any physical aspect of an organism and see what it does, how it works in relation to propelling the organism or consuming food or seeing. But the same goes for everything. We can look at a fork and see that it's to stab food, or a wrench fits nicely onto a bolt and adds torque to it. So with these UFOs, as I described earlier, they have all of the same characteristics we would expect to see in a craft that has the function of achieving backward time travel. So the form specifically being highly electromagnetic, being a massive, rapidly rotating sphere, most commonly disc, are the exact same things that have been described by Van Stockholm with his cylinders and rotating dust, and Gödel with his rotating disc-shaped universe, and Tipler especially, who described cylinders, Tipler cylinders, and discs as well. He said if we flatten it down to a compressed disc of finite size, which made his theory different from the previous two that required an infinite universe or an infinitely long rotating cylinder. Now with these Tipler cylinders, he gave actual numbers in his paper, I think it was 1973 when that came out, showing what metrics we would need. Obviously, we don't have the material science to construct that right now. The centrifugal forces alone would cause it to just shatter. But that electromagnetic aspect, I think, is important too, because a lot of people don't realize that gravity is actually the weakest of the four forces. Electromagnetism is 10 to the 40 times stronger than gravity. So to be able to propel something against gravity, these crafts, the electromagnetic force, it'd be like butter. I mean, there's nothing that would stop it. You just have to control that force. And obviously you have a tremendous amount of energy to be able to power it and create that anti-gravity. But that electromagnetism may also be an aspect of how they can create these closed time-like curves in association with that rapid rotation and the massive craft itself.
So we talked a little bit about motive earlier, or why, let's say. But if you were really to sort of crack the case, let's say, as to beyond curiosity, and we could argue we do a lot of research on this planet for curiosity, whether it's understanding dolphins better or certain cultures in the world, but with an overall idea of it helping our greater understanding of the world, etc. But there's some research that we do around obviously trying to cure diseases that has a level of urgency to it that is very more specific and narrow to helping quote unquote humans. What might you believe is could be the main motive to inspire and the level of urgency and let's say technological advancement to come back here from, let's say, millions of years in the future? What do you think they'd be looking for? And what do you think the problem is they might be looking to solve?
Yeah, that's interesting. And it kind of gets back to the whole issue of time paradoxes. If they did come back to the past to fix something, are they doing something that had always already been done? which would be the case in block time or with the Novikov self-consistency principle? Or is it more in the realm of the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics, where it creates this split in the universe, and there's a new universe, a different timeline, if you will. And I think really until we have a holistic theory of quantum gravity, when we can meld general relativity with quantum mechanics, it's going to be difficult to really know for sure. However, with that said, there are certainly a lot of instances where contactees describe being told, take care of your planet, or you need to avoid conflict, avoid wars. And again, this kind of fits in with the extraterrestrial model. Why would they care unless they're stakeholders in our future, unless they need us to survive for them to exist in the first place? And it kind of helps get around that whole alien invasion thing. I had a good buddy who read the book and said since he was a kid, he was deathly afraid of an alien attack. He watched some movie when he was too young or something. And he said, after reading your book, I no longer think that anymore. What would be the point of going back and destroying your ancestors that you rely on for your own existence? It'd be like the grandfather paradox writ large. So if they are coming back to do things, then there is evidence of that even outside of what people say. The UFO that shut down the Malmstrom Air Force Base, not far from where I am here in Southwest Montana, that's confirmed, that's documented. It's not speculation or conspiracy to say that. So what did they know that we didn't? Was there going to be an accidental launch? Did they notice something weird about our controls? Was that going to exterminate humanity? Who knows? But I definitely think that there's a lot of things we could learn, not just from beings with better technology, but also ones with more empathy and compassion and a better sense of humanity, I guess.
Wow, that's a perfect way to end this. And
well,
yes,
one more question.
Or not.
What do you know about Area 51?
I mean, as a kid growing up, I was really interested in it, and I kind of followed the Bob Lazar saga with whatever was on. Like I said, I've always been interested in this question, so I'd come home and crack out on whatever little show is on, whatever obscure channel back when. Actually, it's always been like that. It's just as much like that now with cable TV. But yeah, I mean, I think at this point, there's probably not much there. The secret's out. You can't have a secret base that everybody knows about. I think Wright-Patterson Air Force Base near Dayton, Ohio was probably much more important during that time. As far as where things went, there is a lot of indications that they went there. But yeah, I think there was a time where Groom Lake and Area 51 was an important place, whether they're reverse engineering what crashed at Roswell or just developing anti-gravity technology there. I don't know as much about it as most people. I'm not a ufologist in that sense, but I do think it's a really interesting place, and I hope we know more about it in the future.
Well, we certainly know more about this particular subject today after having this discussion, and in ways that, you know, I think, again, really broaden the base of the foundation around the overall discussion about topics that, like you said, for many people for many years, especially academics, were kind of third rail type stuff that you didn't really delve into. I'm happy to see that there's a sort of an open-mindedness to start to do that a little more.
And again, it's our job. I mean, that's our job as scientists. And I call on my colleagues to put aside that manufactured stigma that came from Project Grudge and Project Sign and Blue Book and all of these ones that beat us down and beat into our heads that we can't talk about this, and to put that aside and actually start looking at consciousness and UFOs and near-death experiences and things that are taboo, but how do we learn anything if we don't talk about them? I think it's really important that we all continue to ask questions and to continue researching things the best we can.
Well said, amen to that. You mentioned the website earlier. Where else can people find your book?
I mean, really, you just Google either Identified Flying Objects or Dr. Michael P. Masters, and links will come up. Amazon is obviously the main place people buy books, but there's also an audiobook available on Audible and iTunes, and ebooks available in many different places. So spread the love. Go to your local bookstore. They need some help right now with the COVID shutting everything down. Go talk to the nice old lady behind the counter and say, hey, can you get this book in? I'd like to read it.
Excellent stuff. Okay, well, thanks again for joining us. We'll catch up with you down the line.
Awesome. Thanks so much, guys. Appreciate you having me on.
So, excellent chat with Dr. Mike Masters.
Super smart guy.
Super smart. Like, and that's him. The difference when you're talking about big hypotheticals, right? Like, you know, like, what if deals in the biggest hypotheticals, but what if aliens are humans visiting from the future? That's about as big as it gets. But if you're having that conversation with somebody with that level of pedigree and that level of smarts and the ability to look at it very objectively from a science lens,
it's very different from me just narrating the what if.
Yes, right? No, for sure. Like, because we're learning stuff that about evolution, about human evolution and physics and other things that are still applicable regardless of whether you believe mm-hmm. future us are coming back here. But if you do believe that, which, you know, I'm open to whatever, why do you think they might be coming back?
Well, I made the point of course, we've documented everything,
yes.
right? So there's no real point, I don't think, in coming to visit us. He was also talking about going back and seeing, you know, testing the fecal matter of, you know, early hominids. Jeez. And of course, we don't have any of those records, so that would make sense if they yep. wanted to find out more about that. I'm thinking the only reason they come back to somebody in our generation is because maybe they need a sample of, maybe there's a disease that's happening 20 million years in the future, and they're like, oh, this was COVID-19. It happened to Earth in, you know, the year 2020. If we can go back and pick up some antibodies, we can solve the problem that's happening 20 million years in the future.
Look, I'm as open-minded as you're going to get. Personally, if you ask me, are we going to solve time travel at some point? Absolutely, 100%. There's zero doubt I have about that. The science has been circling around it. The further we get from the idea that we have to do it through, you know, the applied idea of light speed and some other things, you know, Dr. Mike Masters talks about the fact that electromagnetism is actually a much stronger for 10 to the power of 40,
yeah,
I think
10
he
to
said,
40, yeah.
than gravity. So when you hear some of these discs described, you often, or not often, but sometimes you hear they're described like they're moving,
but they're stationary.
Yeah. And so it's almost like you could imagine something that has strong electromagnetic force has basically pushed gravity out, and it's
right.
moving without gravity. And that's an interesting idea that I don't think was initially thought about. People were thinking of a time machine like H.G. Wells. You go inside, or Stewie on Family Guy, you press a button,
it's like an elevator. Yeah.
I don't think that's how we get there. And I think there's other ways that we can explore. And it could include multidimensional or parallel universes.
Wormholes. You know,
wormholes. To me, it's more likely something like that that accelerates the travel, if you will, versus the idea that you actually either have to go a long way to get somewhere, or you have to go into a machine and shake around and pop out.
Well, who's to say the future is far away, right? The future may be right here beside me, and maybe, you know, do they need spinning discs?
As he talked about the, you know, the time folding, all of a sudden, if time was linear and it folds this way, this is a shorter trip from here than it was, to your point, it could be
yeah.
literally beside us.
Yeah, it's happening right now. In fact, they're doing this podcast
yes.
in the year 60,077,077.
Hopefully they're doing a better job.
I'd like to thank Dr. Mike Masters again for joining us on What If Discussed. And if you want more What If, why don't you sign up for the What If Explorers Club newsletter? There's tons of cool science stuff, and you can find out what's going on behind the scenes right here at What If. All you have to do to sign up is go to whatifshow.com. That's it for today's show, Richard.
Good times, a lot to think about, a lot to chew on, and as usual with What If Discussed, lots to take away.
We'll be taking it away, and we'll be bringing it back next week on What If Discussed.